Once again, good evening, everyone. My name is Jonathan Neal, along with Bassima Fairhat.
Hello.
Hello. We are again coming your way for a live one-hour broadcast entitled The People Speak With, and tonight the guest is People Speak With Dr. Justin Frank once again. And we are very, very happy that Dr. Frank has decided to give it another shot, because we have had... the past interview had some technical glitches, and they are gone. We are ready to learn about George W. Bush from a psychoanalytical point of view, and we're very excited to welcome the author of a pretty controversial book called Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of a President. And it is a remote viewing and a remote opinion from a professional psychoanalyst that he's giving us his opinions based on experience about George W. Bush. So we are very happy that he was able to come in here this evening again. And Bassima, I know that you missed the last program. I think you were totally removed from Pal Talk reality, and you were not able to get here. And so, as a treat to you, Dr. Frank has returned again, and I want to give you the opportunity to catch up on what you missed before by carrying out a large chunk of this interview, and I hope that works out well for both of you.
Sounds wonderful to me. How about you, Dr. Frank?
Sounds good to me. I'm all ready to talk and listen.
Excellent.
Okay, Dr. Frank, a couple of the things that first of all, the very title of your book is like, when I first heard it, I just laughed. I thought to myself, neither do I want President George W. Bush on the couch, nor do I want to enter that man's mind.
Totally.
And,
I did it out of necessity, not out of desire.
I wondered what prompted you to, you know, and like I said, the inside the mind of a president, not just any president, but President George W. Bush. How insane a place could that possibly be? And as you can probably tell, I'm not a great fan of President Bush, and I'm not ashamed to admit it. One of the things that, for the members of the audience that were not here, and such as myself, What was the impetus for you writing this book? I mean, outside of the fact that you are a psychoanalyst, why suddenly pick on this president as opposed to any other president?
Well, I have actually, I am over 60 years old. I've never written a book before. I like to teach and practice psychoanalysis, and I give lectures on film and culture and write here and there. But during the campaign in 2000, there was something about then-Governor Bush that was quite frightening to me, and I took notice, and he reminded me of some of my patients who were alcoholics, untreated alcoholics, who I saw before they started treatment with me, had very similar styles of talking and thinking, and I was just noticing. But then as he became president and started accumulating power, and after 9/11, I became quite frightened, because he seems like a person who doesn't want to learn from experience, and doesn't like to think, and didn't like to read, and seemed to see things in black and white, and never took responsibility for anything going wrong. And he was very evasive whenever anybody confronted him, and I'd never seen that, all that packaged together in one person. And I got more and more uncomfortable, and as a psychoanalyst, I felt compelled to look deeper, and I started doing that. And one thing led to another, and I wrote a book. And what the impetus really was, how concerned I was, and I was trying to understand what was going on with him. And I wanted also for people to have a chance to actually think about it, because I was also struck I have the press and the media, in particular the television media, was so constantly giving him a free pass and was completely almost indifferent to everything he did, including the announcement that he made in October of 2000 that he had been arrested for a DWI. Look at the furor over Patrick Kennedy. And this is a man who was arrested when he was about, a little younger than Kennedy is now. He was about 30. But he kept drinking for 10 more years, heavily, and just denied the whole thing. It's a very disturbing kind of quality in him. And so I just decided to write it. And there's a tradition in psychoanalysis where people do study famous people, historical figures who can never get in your consulting room, and you use psychoanalytic ways of thinking and looking for patterns and noticing things when you do a careful study of the person, even though they've never been your patient. And then the other thing is that the CIA has been for years hiring psychoanalysts and psychiatrists to study foreign leaders and do what sort of I did.
One of the questions that I wanted to bring to you. How do you justify the legitimacy of a study done done vicariously? And does it have scientific merit?
It does have scientific merit, but psychoanalysis itself, the main strength of psychoanalysis is, of course, having the patient in your consulting room and having the interaction with them where you can actually experience how they distort you and how their past gets relived in the present. So you use your emotional experience in the therapy room, which is something that is really missing in this kind of instance. But I justify it by the fact that there's been a long tradition of psychoanalysts who've done this, starting with Freud, who did Moses, who did actually Leonardo, who did President
Moses,
Woodrow
Wilson. Moses, that's a good one.
Yes. And what happened was, at first people weren't interested, people were concerned with the same question you asked, which is, where are the facts and how is this scientific? But it seems very scientific to me because the book came out in 2004, the first edition, in June of 2004, and for the last 2 years, everything I wrote about in the book, he's done. So it seems very accurate in terms of being predictive. It's really understanding his character and the nature of his behavior. There's not one thing he's done since the book was published that has surprised me or that has been out of character. Not one. I can't think of one thing. And anybody who's read the book recently says that this is exactly how he is. And in fact, I gave a copy of the galley to Kitty Kelly, who was working on an extensive biography of Bush, where she interviewed every member of the family in great detail, and cousins and parents and everybody. And she read it, and she couldn't believe how accurate it was, that my book was so accurate.
Dr. Frank, considering the analysis and your evaluation of President Bush, and as you just said, that nothing that has happened or that you witnessed has surprised you thus far, In the real world of politics, have you noticed any actions that he's taken during his administration that have made you wonder? Especially with the war in Iraq, all of the what's happening now with Iran, is this some kind of inflated ego trip that this man is on that is for me it's scary. To me,
yes.
It looks like he's out of control.
Well, I think he is out of control. And I think that, unfortunately, those around him are not that different from him. So it's really up to members of the Senate and the House to control him and to stop him from doing the things that he's about to do and the things that he's been doing. Unfortunately, they've been going along. I think he lost only two things since he's been president, the Dubai ports. Giving the ports to the Dubai contractors, and then he lost out on Social Security when he had this massive campaign right after the election of 2004. But other than that, he has really gotten his way. He just had more tax cuts, and they're making them permanent. And he's going to send troops to the border of Mexico and California. I mean, he's really doing whatever he wants. I don't know what to say about the ego trip. I think that there is... he has conflated, psychologically, he has conflated himself with God, which I think is already a pretty big ego trip. And
exactly.
He is essentially, in his mind, fairly indistinguishable from God. He is either doing God's work, he is having God speak to him, he is called by God to do these things, and there is a way in which he is a man on a mission. And it's disturbing because it is grandiose, it is messianic, and as a psychoanalyst, when you see people who are this grandiose and this messianic, the first question you ask yourself, or I ask myself, is what is it that they're running away from? Why do they have to build themselves up so much in order to compensate for something else? Because anybody who's in the world in a realistic sense will not be that grandiose and will have some touch of humility or perspective. And he doesn't.
Dr. Francona,
go ahead, John.
I want to take that topic, what you're covering now, and turn it into a slightly different direction after we take a brief break.
Sure.
I want to discuss the grooming of George Bush, being presented as a good old boy, hard-hitting, the kind of a Andrew Jackson, when in reality he is a Connecticut born of privilege related to the Queen. And I want to talk briefly after the break about if you were to strip away some of that reality, some of this grooming from his handlers, what does it boil him down to? Because a large part of his image is propaganda, and it's masterful. They showed him during Earth Day with an axe on his shoulder. He cannot be photographed even on Earth Day without a weapon. Very testosterone oriented, very keyed toward the American male, the good old boy male, who takes action directly and stays on course, and you know how that goes. So I want to discuss after this break get some of your thoughts on that process since the early days of Karl Rove, when they've started to hone George Bush as an evangelical person, a Southern Texan maverick, when we know he's not. He is a privilege, and he's always been a privilege. So we're going to take a break. We have a public service announcement that's ready to go, and we will continue this discussion right after this, so stay with us.
This is Tim Robbins. Recently in Washington, both Democrats and Republicans in high levels of government, the military, and intelligence have risked their careers, their livelihoods, and in some cases their safety to bring information to light to expose the lies, duplicity, and potential crimes of the Bush administration. These patriotic Americans are trying to tell us something. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation. It resulted in articles of impeachment. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor House Resolution 635, for an official investigation into the Bush administration.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org. We have several celebrity figures and people in the media who are agreeing to the wording of that particular public service announcement, and they do feel that an impeachment proceedings, or at least a strong censure to begin with, would be the proper step in order to bring back some form of a balanced government. We don't have three branches anymore. We have the executive, plenary executive, and if people don't understand what plenary is, it's absolute. You can look it up. And that word is used officially as far as the executive's interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. In a time of war, he has plenary power. And you are a person, you're a psychoanalyst who has determined from your past experience and gathering information and data on George Bush that there is a problem here. We have a problem here. This personality has issues, yet this personality has plenary power over the most massive military force in the world, carrying out this testosterone agenda that I asked you about before the break. I want you to go into that. If you were to strip away the influence of the handlers of George Bush, who do their very best to present him as someone who doesn't speak English very well. He's proud of the fact that he kind of tears the language up, because that proves that he's a good old boy, he's a good American boy, and that gives him that very mythical power as an American testosterone-filled male. So cover that. Give me your point of view on that. Go ahead.
My point of view on that is that the reason he does hide the fact that he's from a very privileged background, and that's what his handlers wanted him to do. But he was always able to do that. When he first came to Andover when he was 16 or 15 from Texas, he already had a Texas accent, and he maintained a Southern style and charm all the time. So I don't think that's just because of his handlers or because he wants to be a good old boy. I think it has to do with a way of protecting himself from a fear of being attacked by other people. I think it's a way of trying to manage paranoid anxiety. And one of the ways you do that is by not seeming to be a threat to anyone. You're a good old boy. You're one of the group. You're not going to hurt anybody. And you're going to be likable and affable and easy to get along with. I was just reading something this week that was reprinted, a column from a liberal Democrat named Richard Cohen. I don't know if you ever read any of his stuff, from the Washington Post, who's been very much a thorn in the side of this administration. He's got a level-headed mind, and I've always enjoyed reading him. But somebody took issue with him and reprinted part of a column that he wrote in November of 2000. And in terms of your comment, I think it's worth my reading one sentence from that, because it's so telling about Bush, but also about his power. Richard Cohen wrote, and I quote, this was in November during the Hanging Chad controversy when everybody was going nuts and the president had not been declared, they hadn't figured out what they were going to do. He wrote, given the present bitterness, given the angry, irresponsible charges being hurled by both camps, the nation will be in dire need of a conciliator, a likable guy who will make things better and not worse. That man is not Al Gore. That man is George W. Bush. That's what Richard Cohen said in the Post in the year 2000, November. How could he fool somebody like him and fool so many people? That was stunning to me. And I think that what he does with his affability is he hides two things. I agree with you about hiding the testosterone power, but I think he hides his meanness and his nastiness. It's not that he's hiding his wealth. He's hiding his nastiness and his viciousness and his cruelty. And yet he expresses his cruelty indirectly by making jokes, poking fun at people. But when he was a child, he was very cruel. I mean, he has a long through line of cruel behavior throughout his life, where he would blow up frogs with firecrackers. When he was in college, he would brand pledges in the fraternity house at Yale with a hot coat hanger on their naked buttocks. And then when he was interviewed about that, because somebody confronted him, and because he had a famous family name, it made the New York Times, when he was interviewed, he said, I don't know why people are so upset about it. It's only a cigarette burn. It's just like a cigarette burn. Of course, who goes around burning people with cigarettes? That question wasn't even asked. But the way he minimizes his destructiveness, and he can do that with his charm, and so it's hiding, you're right, the testosterone, but it's not really testosterone. It's sadistic testosterone. Testosterone can be very positive.
Yes,
and
it's
strong.
Privileged. He has privileged cruelty. He's not the first instance of someone with privilege that is a cruel person and has the resources to cover up the trail that they leave behind. If your father
resources, he gets away with it.
If your father was a former head of the CIA and in service of the government, and his grandfather as well, and he has the Andover connections and the Yale connections, and he has the connections to London. I mean, we have literal genetic connections to the Crown of England, and that's not unusual for presidents of the United States. If you trace their lineage, that's happened more than once. But this privileged cruelty added to this plenary executive authority is opening up Pandora's box of the worst proportions for the security of the earth when you have someone at the helm of the most powerful military force in the world, and they're basically a cruel person. It's very, very dangerous, and I do understand the impetus for you to make that analysis, given the current events of the world, the current world events.
The purpose of being so cruel is not only to have pleasure. A lot of people who are cruel, and, you know, sadism and S&M kinds of clubs, and there's all kinds of people who do little cruel things to each other, and they find them erotic or exciting. This is a person who gets not just pleasure out of being cruel. He needs to be cruel, and part of that is to make sure that any trace of being a victim or any trace of being vulnerable is completely evacuated and eradicated from his psyche. So he becomes invulnerable, and he is cruel to other people. They're the suckers. They're the weak people. They're the defective ones. They're the ones where he can feel comfortable injuring and damaging, because it doesn't really matter to him. They're not real people. So I think that the problem is also that the cruelty doesn't work. In other words, once you are cruel and inflict cruelty, the fears that you have and the demons that are around you and the fears of being found out for being weak yourself, or for being not able to read, or for being limited in a different way, or for being short compared to his brother and his father, whatever it is, his fears of all those things don't go away. He gets temporary relief, so he has to become cruel again, and he has to do it again and again and again. So that's why it's now being directed against the American people even more than ever. And it's directed in a variety of ways against, it'll be directed eventually against the people who are closest to him, because he has to. He does not have a choice.
Well, Dr. Frank, it sounds like this is an escalating situation. This theme of inflicting pain and causing distress in the world seems to be something to be that is escalating.
I agree.
Especially in his case. So how do we deal with this? How do we as constituents?
Well, I think there's several ways to start dealing with it, but the first way is for people to start to recognize it. People need to see his cruelty for what it is. And the question is, how do you do that? Especially because he's been lucky that there actually are terrorists, and he's been lucky that there actually are bad things happening, and therefore he can get away with hiding his cruelty by legitimizing it and justifying it. And it takes a long time for people to see how cruel he is. It's the single hardest thing to talk about, because people don't want to think of their president as being cruel or sadistic. After my book came out, I had calls from mothers, three different mothers, right within the first month, of enlisted men who were killed in Iraq. And they all had the same uneasy question, which was, did I think that President Bush actually hates their sons? They didn't each say it in exactly the same way, but it was pretty much the same thing. Did I think, given what I had written, that there's something about hating people to the extent that he pretends to really like them and support them, but he sends them out to be killed? And what's
exactly
that about? And I think that people get it. Some people.
Dr. Frank, do you think that any of this, I know that, you know, as you stated, that he had some serious psychological issues and episodes of extreme cruelty as a child. Didn't he have a sister that had been killed? And how do you think that affected? What was her name? I think it was Robin. Do you think that affected that in any way?
Well, I think it did, because what happened was his sister, he was the firstborn, and when you're the firstborn, you have a special place, and as a firstborn male, given our patronymic culture, that's a big deal. But what happened was he had a sister born when he was 3 1/2, and then when he was 7, she died. She contracted leukemia and died within a couple of months. He was in second grade. There was no funeral. There was no talk about her death. The parents actually were obviously distressed, but they played golf the next day.
Wow.
Which is a shocking fact. And he was left to his own devices. And I think you can see, even now, he doesn't ever go to the funerals of enlisted men. He avoids grief and loss. One of the things that happens, however, when you're seven and a sibling dies, is it's very confusing to a seven-year-old, because they may think, the seven-year-old, that they had something to do with the death, that their wishes may have had something to do with it, that their rivalry may have had something to do with it. I wish you'd send, you know, so many older kids will say, oh, send my little sister and my little brother back to the hospital now. It's been nice for a few days, but when is the baby going back? I mean, people have those feelings. Those are normal feelings. But if you don't have a way to discuss them or manage them, especially after there's been a death, all he learned from his parents was, don't talk about it. Don't look at it. It will go away.
The disturbing point you made earlier about playing golf the day after brings to mind the clip of
it's George seen in 9/11.
Yes, making that strong anti-terrorism statement with the scowl. You know, he had the furrowed brow, and then he turns and says, "Now watch this drive." That alone tells you where the priorities are of people of a particular privilege.
It's not where the priorities are. It is. It tells you how they can split their mind.
It's a form of avoidance.
They disconnect. It's a form of avoidance. It's a form of triumphing over things.
Is that similar to the bipolar situation?
Well, it's not like bipolar. It's called schizoid, technically, which means the ability to split your mind. And it's like a child will play cowboys and Indians, at least when I was a child, and there was good guys and bad guys. There were white hats and black hats. And I remember watching television with my son, whose son would say, do we like him or don't we like him? Is he a good person or a bad person? That's how people organize their minds when they're growing up.
And there is no guilt in that situation, then, is there? It's
right.
With.
Right. But he never got to integrate those splits. He never got to work them through where in most adults we are able to see that things are more complicated and it's not just all good or all evil.
I've often thought, Doctor, that a psychological evaluation should be mandatory. I mean, when it comes to the office of the president of the greatest nation on the planet Earth, you know, I find it ludicrous that we don't have some kind of an evaluation of the men that take these roles. And I've never been able to understand why anybody would even question the fact that it would be needed.
I agree with you completely. And I don't understand why either. I think it's really essential because you've learned how people function.
Yeah, it almost leaves you like astounded. Like, what do you say when we don't even evaluate our presidency?
Right.
Psychologically, see if they're fit.
Right.
And well, those who went down to Florida and stopped the count, those operatives of the fanatical Republican PMAC wing that went down I think they had their sights set on what's happening now, knowing how George Bush is. You know, they know him personally.
Yeah.
And they know that he's a reactionary, and he's very reactionary. And if you were to present with him some scenario of America being under attack, and then you paint some enemy to fill the void, naturally he's going to be the war president and the decider. And to me, that is very disturbing. We are about halfway through this program this evening, and it is coming up on the time for another break. Tonight, we are going to again give the attentive members of our PalTalk audience the opportunity to get a free autographed copy of Dr. Justin Frank's book, Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of a President. And you better be on your toes, folks, because it's going to be the first person to put the correct answer in the room will be notified by one of our admins in the room, Mesta, and she will tell you how you can get the free copy of this book. So when we come back, we'll continue fairly briefly with the interview between Basima and myself, and we do want to reserve a good chunk of time, Dr. Frank, for audience questions. We already
have four
people are in the queue, and they have been in the queue for a while, so we're going to get, definitely we're going to save some time to get to those, hopefully a good 20 minutes or so toward the end. So right now, let's go ahead and take another break, 30 to 45 seconds, and then when we come back, we are going to share with the room tonight's quiz, tonight's question, and the correct answer, the first correct answer in the room to tonight's giveaway question will receive a free autographed copy of Dr. Frank's book, Push on the Couch. So stay with us. We'll be back very briefly. So, put a break. Thanks. Pal Talk is the largest and most popular internet chat community in the world, with over 39 million registered users worldwide. There are approximately 4 million active users and between 30 and 70,000 people using Pal Talk at any given time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The Pal Talk support staff cover 32 basic languages and countless dialects. Pal Talk is pretty much comparable to any major city in the world, the virtual online equivalent of a global community. Okay, Basma, do you want to, should I, or do you want to read tonight's question?
You go for it, John.
Okay. For those of you who have been paying attention, this answer was mentioned once. Basma said it, so she didn't put it in the room in text, so hopefully you heard when she said it. The question tonight, and the first person to answer this question correctly in the room, according to the person Mesta, she is the one that is going to watch, and she'll make the final decision. The first person to answer this following question correctly will receive the free copy of Dr. Frank's book, Bush on the Couch. Okay, here we go. For the first person, here's the question. George Bush's most traumatic childhood experience was the death of his 6-year-old sister. What was her name? And I see the answers rolling by in the room. We have a couple of people that have it correct. We'll let Mesta decide which one of those came in first, and then she will be getting up with this Pal Talk member and let them know how they can receive a free copy of that book. And Dr. Frank, these people are very attentive. The correct answer is continuing to scroll across the text window in Pal Talk.
Very good, very good.
Can't pull the wool over these people's eyes.
No.
And Asma, if you're still with us, if you want to go ahead and we'll continue the interview part just for a few more minutes, and then we want to reserve some time after the break that's going to come up soon. In the next few minutes, we'll want to share the time after that break for the audience questions. And now there are 5 people waiting in the queue. Go ahead, Basma.
Dr. Frank, I'd like to address the issue of Bush's devout Christian religious fervor. How is this playing into his psychological, I mean, outside of the fact that it just given the nature of the position itself as president of the greatest nation on the face of the earth, literally anybody that takes that or aspires to take that position is literally God on earth. Do you believe that George W. Bush wants more than that?
Well, one of the psychologically, the basic issue, I think, for George Bush is to find effective ways to manage anxiety. And the anxiety that he is mainly trying to manage is either anxiety about being attacked or being weak and vulnerable, which is why he attacks others and makes them weak, or anxiety about that has to do with shame about his own failures, which he's had as a child, or anxiety, really, about falling apart. And he's always tried to manage his anxiety in a variety of ways. And the most recent one, since he was 40 and had his conversion, has been through religion. And the way religion helps him manage his anxiety is that he uses religion personally in order to be certain, in order to be calm, in order to feel that he's doing the right thing, in order to feel that he's doing God's work. But what he wants mainly is to build a world in which he is certain, which there's no room for doubt, when he knows what's right no matter what. And the purpose of that is to manage any kind of anxiety or fear or potential disorganization or distress. That's why he is unable to tolerate conflicting information. If he has two truths presented to him, like there are more than one truth in the world, He is unable to entertain that, and he immediately dismisses it. He immediately says, I don't do nuance. He immediately has contempt for anything that involves thinking or looking things over. He has said he is the decider. That's what he does. And even the grammatical construction of the term decider is the kind of thing that a five-year-old would say. I'm the decider. I mean, my son had a friend who was five, and I remember I asked him a question once, and he said, I can't tell you right now, but I'm going to go and ask my finger. And I thought that was very cute and funny, but he was five. This man is 60 and is the president.
He's not five anymore.
He talks just like a five-year-old. So the purpose of religion is, at one level personally, to confer certainty and to make him calm. It is the replacement for alcohol. Alcohol
is
the same thing.
Do you think he is replacing alcohol? Or do you think
he may have fallen off the wagon. He's fallen off a Segway, and he may have fallen off the wagon in the same way. I don't know. But he, whether he's drinking or not, the point that I want to make is that his search is for certainty and for calm. Now, the fact is that his approach to religion fits with a lot of other people, and there is an evangelical fervor in this country. There's a long tradition of it, and I assume many of the people in your audience and have read the Kevin Phillips' most recent book about religion in this country. It's a very disturbing book, at least it was to me.
I saw an interview of him, Dr. Frank, and you were correct. He made some very very strong points as far as the
very strong points and very
American evangelical dominionist movement. Who are happy and content to let the world fall away from them because their salvation includes a rebuilding of the earth of some sort or something like that.
Right, but the purpose of that kind of, see, to me, that is different from a spirituality that promotes growth and change. This is a spirituality that allows you to turn your back on the world and to not feel any responsibility for what happens here. As long as you are personally saved, you don't have any responsibility to worry about. You can just say whatever you want, do whatever you want. And it's a very destructive and very disturbing kind of twist of a spiritual approach.
Well, one of George Bush's spiritual teammate, Pat Robertson, have you heard what he has said the last couple of days? I'm sure you're aware of it.
Well, unbelievable what he said. I mean, he said
making a prediction of a tsunami, an American tsunami, and yes. There was an online poll I visited briefly today on MSNBC, and 80% of the participants do not believe Pat Robertson when he's, I don't know the count. Usually it's about 50,000 people will respond. It was around 80% saying they did not believe Pat Robertson, what he had said. But maybe there is still hope. We are going to move to the segment of the program after this next break where now we have six people in the queue who want to, are very eager to ask you questions, Dr. Frank. So we're going to take one more public service announcement break, and when we come back, either Bassima or myself will introduce the speakers in the room. We'll just take turns or whatever. We kind of work off the cuff here, and then we'll take a break.
I would like to remind everyone that we are being broadcast on Cosmic Waves Radio Network, and we're very proud to be affiliated with them, as well as Pal Talk, www.paltalk.com.
And we generally also make available a recording of the program online. We'll point the participants in the room how to actually get access to the program later, where they can, in case they missed Dr. Frank's interview, they can play it back. And then hopefully we'll be able to do that pretty soon. It doesn't take long in today's modern technological world to make recordings and put them online. So hopefully that'll be soon after tonight's program. We'll make that available. We are going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, Bassima, if you want, you can. We do need to announce, Nesta needs to let us know who won the book. I'm not real clear on who did it yet, so we need to get a final word on who won the free copy of Dr. Frank's book, Bush on the Couch, autographed version. And hopefully Nesta will get that information to us soon, and we will announce the winner a little bit later in the program. So right now, let's take a break. This will be another public service announcement for about 30 to 45 seconds, and we'll let her go, and we'll be right back after this. Thanks.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
That's when we have a winner. We have a winner.
Yeah, we do.
Dr. Frank, the winner is a very good Pal Talk friend of ours, and we want to send congratulations out to her. That's why you can go ahead and announce who won.
Congratulations to Dari. Dari, we saw that. I guess John and I were the only ones in the room that didn't know that you had won. Congratulations. Right now we're going to be bringing our audience up to the microphones. Please state your first name and where you're calling from, and if you could, please, since there are a number of people that want to ask questions, state a brief question. Thank you very much. Our first guest is Crab Fisherman.
Thank you. Dr. Frank, it's an honor to get to speak to you. I actually read your book about a year ago, and I found it absolutely fascinating reading. However, when I cross-referenced some of your material, I also found that there were an equal number of psychiatrists, including professor at the University of California, professor of psychiatry at the University of Minnesota, Dr. David Burns, who disagreed with your analysis and actually made remarks such as, quote, psychoanalytic hatchet job, unquote. Obviously, you've received a lot of heat from your colleagues in this industry, and I also wanted to know, you've never hidden the fact that you have a very partisan relationship against the president. Do you think that you were able to be 100% objectionable and fair in this?
That was an interesting slip you
made.
I've been, there's no such thing for a psychoanalyst to be 100% objective. In fact, I don't even think the Encyclopedia Britannica is 100% objective. They select what things to put in and what things to leave out. And there always are selected facts that are excluded. And the person who does the selecting thinks he's being or she's being objective, but that's not clear what their biases are. I'm very clear about my biases, although I have treated Republicans in my practice. But I really there has not been one psychiatrist, including the people you've cross-referenced, who said what they've said after they've read the book in detail. I don't think there are any psychiatrists who can quarrel with the analysis in this book. It is pretty tight. What they don't like is the fact that they feel that I'm taking advantage of my professional standing in the community and am doing something that is a political hatchet job on their hero, George Bush. But I really feel that I'm not doing that. In fact, I was surprised that there's been people from the left who read this book and felt that I was being too compassionate for him. And, you know, I shouldn't point out that he has suffered and that his parents were disconnected from him and that there are certain aspects of shame about not being able to read well and all of those things. And my feeling is that he's a human being who should not be president, period. If he were a guy you met in a bar, a salesman, there are lots of people who are not that different from him. They're full of themselves, they're grandiose, they're frightened, they toot their own horn, they don't like intimacy, they make jokes to keep people at a distance, they like to see things in black and white. I mean, he's speaking to a very receptive audience because there's a lot of people like that. So I don't feel that I'm being particularly hard on him, other than that he shouldn't be in this job. He's not able to do it. And he also is not in touch with his destructiveness.
If there was such a thing as a presidential application, you would automatically...
He would fail.
He would fail. He would be a File 13 candidate, more than likely, pretty quickly.
Yes. He is a person who became president because of affirmative action. He had the affirmative action of the privilege.
Interesting.
Getting into schools. getting into these schools without having grades. I mean, he graduated from Yale, got an MBA at Harvard, and he can barely speak. How did that happen? Well, this is affirmative action. He was promoted above beyond his ability.
Dr. Frank, we still have four more people
okay.
that are going to ask
I'll be
questions.
Quiet.
We'll go ahead.
No,
that's fine. We'll go ahead.
No, John don't be quiet.
Kuhl.
We want you
don't
to talk.
Quiet. No. John Kuhl, next in the queue. John Kuhl. I guess it's Kuhl. If you have a question ready, tell us, if you would, your name, if you want to, where you're from, and ask your question briefly, if you would. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. My name is John Kuhl from the Netherlands, Europe. Wonderful to finally have a psychoanalyst, Dr. Justin Frank, about Bush. I have a very important question, a European question. When Bush came to Europe in Denmark in 30th of June 2005, he was talking like a human being. He said, he talks about dependency of oil is a threat to national security, and we have to diversify away from fossil fuel. We are hooked. I mean, I have it stand by, this quote. It's unbelievable that he is talking, you know, like a human. You would not expect that he makes some sense in Denmark. So I was waiting for CNN to, you know, that he does it too in the United States, but he doesn't repeat it anymore. So my question is there a reason that he behaves differently in Denmark, in a small country in Europe, than in his own country that's supposed to be a free country? That's my question. And also I have a fragment on CNN that he is for being a dictatorship, like making a joke about it. I have also standby this proof. Both of them are standby. One is 8 seconds and the other one is 28 seconds. Okay, that's it.
Did you want to play those?
Dr. Frank, no, he was mentioning something that most of the people here have heard already.
Okay. Well, the basic thing is that he is able to talk like a human. And that goes along with the same comments you were making earlier in the hour about his charm and his boyishness and his affability and his good old boy. There are ways in which he can size up a crowd when he's with a group of people, and he can talk about things that will appeal to them. Any good politician is able to do that. The thing that is so disturbing to me is that he'll say something, and what you don't realize when you're in the audience is that he doesn't mean a word of it and that he's actually teasing you. And there is a cruelty even in that statement about fossil fuel that I find disturbing. It's like I used to have this thought that his father would be away, let's say, drilling for oil, and then he'd run home and see little George, give him the big hug, and say, "Hi, Daddy loves you. Goodbye." And is that love? I mean, saying that to get a kid excited and then you disappear again, that's sort of what he's done to the world and certainly to the American people. So I don't find it. It is striking what he said in June 30th of 2005. I agree with you when he was in Denmark. But he said those kinds of things in the past, but just very briefly. As far as the joke about being a dictator, you know, he said he's all in favor of it as long as he's a dictator. I think that it's an example of what we call kidding on the square. He's acting like he's kidding, but he's actually telling us what he's feeling and what he's doing. He wants things done his way, and that's very clear. I think that he is able to charm people. And
obviously he's charmed the entire. He's charmed enough to get into office twice.
I think I think there are some very devoutly religious people who have voted for him because they've been tricked, they've been taken advantage of, and they really felt he was sincere about his religion. And I just don't think he is.
Well, our next question is coming from R.J. Swan. And RG is a good friend of ours, and I think, RG, your name and your question, please, for Dr. Frank.
Thank you very much, Dr. Frank. This is RG in Louisville, Kentucky. My name is actually RG. Now, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. I'd also like to put this into text. That is half.com, which is owned by eBay, and your book is doing very well on half.com. Also, on some other sources, but this was an excellent source for anybody who would like to gather to grab a hold of your book. I'd like to ask you, sir, please, doctor, do you think the American people have learned anything from this horrendous experience? Do you think we've learned to possibly put a little more weight on the intellect of the individual that we choose to lead our country? Please.
Thinking about for the next project I've been working on and thinking about, which is what have we learned from this experience, and is there a way to think about it psychologically and psychoanalytically? I think that to take this man seriously for many people it means that you actually have to do a lot more work. That a representative government is not just electing somebody and hoping they do the best job and forgetting about it as a citizen for the next 4 years. You have to actually pay attention to what they're doing. And I think George Bush counted on the very likely possibility, which I think is what happened, that people won't pay attention and that he'll just do whatever he wants. So well into the second year of the Iraq War, a majority of people still linked Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. A majority of people still felt that, 6 months into the war, still felt that there were weapons of mass destruction there. So I don't know what people have learned other than that if you distrust your leader and you think about what they're doing, you have more responsibility as a citizen. And people have a lot to deal with on their plates already, with their families, with work, with all kinds of problems with relationships and children and everything else that's going on, jobs, that they want to be able to elect somebody who will take care of things. And we've elected somebody who promised to take care of things and didn't. The question is whether this will be a wake-up call. I don't know. I really don't know. I would hope people can learn from their mistakes rather than just have a massive reaction and, you know, throw every Republican out, which, you know, is tempting. But I think that that's the same thing. It's just thinking the way George Bush does.
Okay. I don't want to do that. I don't think any of us want to do that. Our next question is from Walks the Desert. Walks, please give us your name and where you're calling from.
This is Steve in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Dr. Frank, first of all, I'd like to thank you on behalf of everybody here that is listening to you, and it's really a good show. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day to talk to us. You know, we skirted the issue, Dr. Frank, and we've talked about it, I think, but we haven't mentioned it specifically. Isn't the symptoms that George W. Bush is showing, isn't it one of children or adult children that have suffered under abuse, post-traumatic stress syndrome from abuse? And I'll let you have the mic. Thanks, Doctor.
I think that's a very important question. And he does fit a lot of criteria of a child who has suffered from abuse. Specifically, denial of responsibility. Even when he's abusing others, he presents himself as a victim. He says he has to do certain things because this is the way it is. I know you don't like being spied on, but it's necessary. It's for your own good. I know you don't like being beaten, but I'm doing it for your own good. This beating hurts me more than it hurts you, even though I'm the one inflicting it on you. All of those are patterns that are very consistent with that of an adult child, of an adult who had been abused as a child. And I do think, I know that he was hit by his mother. I don't know the extent of it, but I know that he was punished physically by his mother, and that is in the memoirs, and that's written about by his brothers, too. But I think that there's another kind of abuse that's more subtle, which is not overt abuse, but it's the abuse of neglect. It's the abuse of saying one thing and doing another. So people get tricked. And my feeling about Bush and my thoughts about him has been that he is actually inflicting upon us, the citizens of this country, the kinds of things that he felt were inflicted upon him by his parents, which again fits with your question about abuse, because that's one of the things that abuse victims do. They abuse the next generation, or they abuse whoever needs them in the way they were abused themselves years earlier. And so it does fit with that pattern.
Well, thank you.
We have the time for a couple more questions, Dr. Frank. Looks like we have about 6 or 7 minutes remaining in the program, and that should be enough time to get the next. We have two more people that are still waiting to ask the questions. Hopefully we can get your response to those questions before we have to call the program to an end. The next person in the queue is Tweedledee. I think he's a cousin to Tweedledum. I think I've seen that name for this person as well. Come up to the mic, Tweedledee, and tell us your name and where you're from, and let's try to be brief if we can, so we have just a little bit of time remaining. Go ahead.
I have no problem being brief. Thank you, Mr. Dr. Frank, for taking my question. My name is Steve, and I'm from Oregon. I hear a lot of psychological comparisons between President Bush and Adolf Hitler on the Internet. Do you, as a doctor, see any similarities between these two personality types as a psychoanalyst? And that's the end of my question. Thank you for your time.
There are some similarities, and they are disturbing similarities. Again, the intolerance for what's called cognitive dissonance, in other words, the inability to process any information that goes against the preconception that Bush has or that Hitler had about what was right and what was going on. Yeah, there's a great movie, I forgot the name of it, I want to say The Final Days, but I don't know if that's the name of it, that is about the last days of Hitler in the bunker, and it's a terrific German-made movie, very disturbing and powerful. But one of the things that they have several different things in common, and even historically they have some things in common with their parentage, with their prejudices, with their seeing things in black and white, and with their ability to charm people and their pleasure at being cruel and making nasty jokes at other people's expense. They also had a need to build themselves up at the expense of other people. But I think that, there are similarities. I don't know what else to say. There are similarities. There was a very detailed psychoanalytic study of Hitler that was done, commissioned by President Roosevelt in 1942, which I unfortunately have not had access to. It's at Hyde Park Library, and I'd like to read it sometime. I'd be very curious what they wrote.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor. And our next question is coming from Isaiah. Isaiah, come to the mic, give us your name and where you're calling from, and a brief question.
Hi there, my name's Isaiah. I'm coming from my igloo deep inside downtown Canada. My question is that the policies that the Bush administration has come up with have caused a lot of damage to the American psyche. Not to make it sound like the American psyche is being a victim here, but what kind of advice would you give us in order to heal from Bush and his policies as they have existed and as they will continue to batter, it seems, the way people are? If you've got any advice on how we can heal from this, I'd certainly like to hear it. Thanks very much.
I think it's a great way to have the last question about healing, because I think that that's so important. And one of the things that is central is that part of early child rearing involves the process of breaking and repairing. Every time a mother has to get up from nursing her baby to go to the bathroom or wash or answer the phone, she breaks a bond momentarily and the baby may cry, and then they have to repair it. And that's a process that goes on a daily basis in the early years. There have been a lot of things that have been broken in this country in the last few years. And I think that one of the ways of healing it involves taking responsibility, not just to blame Bush for breaking the bonds of the American psyche or breaking our trust, but people have to take responsibility for their own complicity, their own willingness. For instance, Congresswoman, I'll just name some names. Congresswoman Jane Harman was proud to have voted along with Congressman Dick Gephardt to give Bush money so he could have leverage in negotiating with Saddam Hussein. I happen to know Jane personally, and I was outraged at what she did. I wrote her a very angry note, and we talked about it, and she said that she thinks that it's important for him to have the support of the people. And I said that you can't do that. People like that have to admit their mistakes. People like that have to take responsibility for things they've done wrong and for their complicity. What we're asking of George Bush, which is to look at himself and to take responsibility, and we have to stop him, we have to also ask that of ourselves, because if we're just going to oppose somebody, we have to also look at the whole group of people who supported him, like the Richard Cohn quote I read earlier. People have to take responsibility for thinking those things and saying those things. And those, the rest of us who knew how dangerous he was, cannot be "I told you so's" or "why didn't you listen to me," because that doesn't help a person heal either. We have to really have some way of being open for people to really talk about the mistakes they've made. Germany actually is a country that did that. It's the only nation I know who's done that, because they've done a lot of healing under Adenauer after World War II, and they really did talk about the responsibility. Even the people who said, "Oh, we didn't know about the camps, we didn't know what was going on." I think people taking responsibility can go a long way to healing. And then the other thing that's important is for people to be alert to what he's doing. For instance, it's on Fridays, after hours, that he does the signing statements where he changes the laws and passes them to his own liking. And there's a lot of people who have read my book, and they feel that I'm not saying anything different from what they already know. It's just said in an organized way and helps them think about it. But the issue then is that we have to be mindful. It's up to us to be aware, to be mindful, to pay attention, to read the papers, to really get information, and to speak up. It's very important, because he's a frightened man, and he's a frightening man. And he inflicts his illness, his conflicts, on the rest of us. So we have to pay attention, as I wrote, to his mockery, to his distortions of reality, and to his ability to instill fear, and we have to stand up to that and pay attention.
Well, our guest tonight has been Dr. Justin Frank, and it's a wonderful read. It's an incredible book. It's an incredible insight into our presidency. And the book is Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of a President. Dr. Frank, we want to thank you for being with us this evening. I know for me and for many of our audience members, this has been a great pleasure. You've offered us an incredible insight and things that we had not ordinarily thought about, I guess. We're here with CWRN, Cosmic Wave Radio Network. Thank you guys all. And Pal Talk, thank you very much.
I want to give thanks to Carrie, who has been in the shadows organizing the Qs and the PSAs. We want to give him kudos to Carrie. Thank you very much. Dr. Frank, I want to share with you my great pleasure that this was not a revisit of the last technical thing we had going on.
Right.
This has gone very well. It's been very informative. Great questions.
Wonderful.
From people in the room. Excellent questions. And you know how it goes in this particular scenario. We have to come to the point where we have to say goodnight. And this is...
Well, I want to say one quick thing. This is a good example of break and repair, which is that the first time it was really problematic, and I could have said, oh, the hell with it, and you could have said that. And coming back and doing it and getting it right is really an important experience for all of us.
And Dr. Well, Frank, next week we're going to feature Howard Zinn. And Howard Zinn has the people's history of the United States. It should be a hoot. I'm expecting it to be very, very energetic. And we do want to tell everyone who's listening on the Cosmic Waves Radio Network to go to www.paltalk.com, download the software, get yourself a microphone, and come and join us in this forum. And once again, next week our guest will be Howard Zinn. It should be Thursday from 8 until 9 on the program that we call The People Speak. It's a one-hour live broadcast where we bring people in who have very, very, very important opinions that need to be shared. We need to get the information spread about in order to empower ourselves, in order to heal, as Dr. Frank had mentioned. And Dr. Frank, if you would, after we close tonight's program, we want to get in touch with you in private and stay on the line. We want to talk to you very briefly before we let you go. And now we're going to go ahead and bring one of our good friends, beautiful singer, Annie DeFranco, has the closing song for tonight. This land is your land and this land is my land. We're going to go to Annie DeFranco, and after that we're going to call the show. We're going to call it a night. Thanks everyone for coming, and do please bring your questions next week, and we will see you next week at 8 o'clock on The People Speak. Night.
Good night all. One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city born by the rolling waters, that summer people make the day hungry when I stood there wondering how this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is mine. There's from California to New York Island, redwood forest, the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.